first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. A US judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the US intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing a cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing, and as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice? It seems that the young and inexperienced Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has allowed the power to go to his head, already forging a negative reputation for himself, as demonstrated in his range of recklessly backed actions since taking the position of Crown Prince. Yet could his actions now be coming back to haunt him? With the order by the US court to expose the tapes surrounding the murder, could the heavily cash-influenced and petrodollar relationship between the US and the Saudi regime be turning sour? Bin Salman's also been accused of sending a murder hit squad to Canada to assassinate former Saudi intelligence official Saad al-Jabri, something that Bin Salman strongly denies. Yet all the evidence points towards the favoured modus operandi of the Crown Prince following the foiling of the plot by the Canadian security services. There's also speculation that Bin Salman met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a secret meeting just prior to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, the meeting has been denied, yet somehow suggests that Bin Salman was aware and briefed about the Israeli regime plot to murder on Iranian soil. But there's a saving grace for Bin Salman, namely the protection he enjoys from the current US President, Donald Trump. Following the murder of Khashoggi, Trump was happy to turn a blind eye to the event, likely dazed by the wads of cash flowing in from Saudi Arabia to the US through arms deals and more.
We also have a great ally in Saudi Arabia. They give us a lot of jobs, they give us a lot of business, a lot of economic development.
What now remains to be seen is whether the president-elect, Joe Biden, will be as accommodating towards Bin Salman as his predecessor. And if not, will Bin Salman survive without Uncle Donald by his side?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Britain and the European Union enter the final stretch of the Brexit negotiations, with renewed hope of a deal being struck within days after Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen agreed to go the extra mile and ordered the resumption of talks in Brussels. As the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson played down expectations following a telephone conversation with the European Commission President. European Union embassies in Brussels were briefed that progress has been made and that the next few days will be important. UK negotiators are expected to stay in Brussels until at least Tuesday, 15th of December. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Daniel Buffy and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Johnson and EU Vow to Go Extra Mile to Thrash Out Brexit Deal. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy and Jessica Elgott's article. Britain and the EU entered a final stretch of the Brexit negotiations with renewed hope of a deal being struck within days after Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen agreed to go the extra mile and ordered the resumption of talks in Brussels. As Prime Minister Boris Johnson played down expectations following a telephone conversation with the European Commission President, European Union embassies in Brussels were briefed that progress has been made and that the next few days will be important. UK negotiators are expected to stay in Brussels until at least Tuesday, 15th of December. There were reports over the weekend that government sources had put the chance of no deal at 80%. The leaders' phone call at noon, Brussels time on Sunday, 13th of December, had been presented as a point by which a firm decision would be made on the prospects of a trade and security deal, with Boris Johnson saying on Friday, 11th of December, that it was very, very likely the talks would end in failure. In the event, shortly after the phone call, Ursula von der Leyen and Boris Johnson released a joint statement saying, despite the exhaustion after almost a year of negotiations, despite the fact that deadlines have been missed over and over, we think it is responsible at this point to go the extra mile. It was the two sides had a responsibility to keep on working. We had a useful phone call this morning. We discussed the major unresolved topics. Our negotiating teams have been working day and night over recent days. We have accordingly mandated our negotiators to continue the talks and to see whether an agreement can even at this late stage be reached. However, in a separate statement, Boris Johnson said he had briefed the cabinet to be ready for a no-deal Brexit. The Prime Minister said his request to open talks directly with Berlin and Paris had been rejected by Brussels. The Commission is very determined to keep the negotiations the way that they have been done between us, and that's fine, he said. The most likely thing now is, of course, that we have to get ready for World Trade Organization terms, Australia terms, and don't forget, everybody, we've made huge preparations for 4.5 years, perhaps more intensively in the last couple of years. He added, I think that the United Kingdom should continue to try, and I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try, and we're going to try with all of our hearts, and we'll be as creative as we possibly can. But what we can't do is compromise on that fundamental nature of what Brexit is all about. The former Cabinet Minister Ian Duncan-Smith said MPs now expected that the talks would go to the wire, though others said the negotiations must be done in time for Parliament to scrutinise the deal. It is dawning on European leaders that we're serious about leaving without a deal, Ian Duncan-Smith said. We're now at the end of the beginning. Between now and the 31st, is where we will get serious compression. Ian Duncan Smith said Boris Johnson would have a problem back home if there was any give from the United Kingdom side under level playing field terms. However, he said a short extension to allow the ratification might even be acceptable as long as a deal was done by 31st of December. If push comes to shove, they can give themselves a bye post 31st of December of a month while the sides sort out their legislation, as long as these issues are sorted satisfactorily, he said. David Jones, the vice chair of the European Reform Group of Hard Brexit Tories, said MPs would be prepared to read a deal on Christmas Day and vote in between Christmas and the New Year. But he said it will be highly preferable for MPs to scrutinise the deal, including taking legal advice before the final deadline. Von der Leyen travelled to Paris on Sunday, 13th of December, to see President Emmanuel Macron for a pre-scheduled dinner. In Berlin, Angela Merkel said the European Union should try everything to get an agreement. Johnson said he had wanted to involve Merkel and Macron in the talks, but had been rebuffed again by the European Commission. The negotiating position hasn't changed in any way, and the fact that the talks are not easy is clear, Angela Merkel said. Britain is leaving the internal market, and we, of course, need to make sure that there are fair conditions for competition in place if the legal situation between the United Kingdom and the European Union moves further apart. Ireland's Foreign Minister Simon Coveney said, "I think both sides do want a deal and they want a deal now. My view is that the deal can be done, but it really needs to be done within the next few days." European Union sources said the two sides were finding common ground over clauses in a potential deal designed to ensure neither side could undercut the other as they set their own regulatory standards. The negotiations between the teams, led by United Kingdom's chief negotiator David Frost and his European Union counterpart Michel Barnier, ran until midnight on Saturday, with the British team ending the evening with sandwiches in the UK ambassador's residence. Boris Johnson said the United Kingdom and the European Union remain very far apart on these key issues. He added, "Let's see what we can achieve. If Ursula is optimistic, then that's great. As far as I can see there are some serious and very difficult issues that currently separate the United Kingdom from the European Union." The biggest stumbling block to a deal has been the EU's demand for an evolution or ratchet clause in the treaty that would create a mechanism to ensure that a minimum baseline of environmental, social and labour standards evolves over time to ensure there is no significant distortion of trade. Number 10 Downing Street has said the EU's proposal would tie the UK to follow regulatory changes in Brussels on pain of automatic tariffs. Arbitration over those tariffs would only then follow. It is understood that the European Union has agreed that tariffs should be applied only once there is clear evidence that regulatory changes by one side have significantly distorted trade. David Frost tabled a fresh proposal on Saturday. In a sign of a meeting of the minds, the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab agreed that comments from the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte on Friday about the need for a structured way to address distortions to trade had been welcome. Dominic Raab said, "Mark Rutte is one voice, he's normally pretty pragmatic, and we're normally quite close to the Dutch on these matters. There are plenty of other voices. The bottom line is this: are we required to follow EU rules, past, present, future, and do we have a situation where we are exercising normal control over our own laws, as any democracy does, that we suddenly find there is a torpedo of tariffs?" The Irish Taoiseach Michael Martin said last week's agreement on implementing the Northern Ireland Protocol showed that the two sides could reach accommodation on difficult issues. Ireland's Taoiseach said, I think it would be an appalling failure of statecraft if we were not in a position to get a deal over the line.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor and we're broadcasting from London. Now, we'll get to the situation of Brexit in just a moment, but first, supporters of WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange have reported the shocking conditions he's currently being kept in at the UK's maximum security Belmarsh prison, with fears he may die behind bars. According to several reports, a coronavirus outbreak has forced inmates to be kept in solitary confinement for extended periods. A judgment on his extradition case is expected on the 4th of January next year, and US prosecutors have indicted him on 17 espionage charges and one count of computer misuse over the publication of secret American military documents just over a decade ago. Now, those charges carry a maximum sentence of 175 years in prison. A new push to release the whistleblower is underway, with the Australian Member of Parliament George Christensen reaching out to outgoing US President Donald Trump to grant Assange a pardon. Well, John White, the author and political commentator, joins us. John, it must be said that there have been so many who believe that the WikiLeaks revelations about Hillary Clinton helped Trump to get into the White House. Can you see outgoing President Donald Trump issuing a pardon as a kind of final act of defiance?
Good evening. I mean, I do think that's entirely feasible. Trump has set his face against his own intelligence community almost from the first day he entered the White House at the beginning of 2017. And this, as you say, would be one final act of defiance as he leaves that office. But I hope he does. It would salvage for me something of his otherwise horrific legacy as president, a one-term president. And obviously there's a campaign now underway, gathering momentum by the day, in Australia, in the UK and in the US, to have him pardoned and released. This man is being persecuted, not prosecuted. And the legal briefs, the lawyers, the judges who are involved in this farce in the UK, they are acting now essentially as a posse of upper class, privately educated reprobates, acting not in the interests of justice, but in the interests of a sheriff in Washington.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because the court case has thrown up a number of anomalies, including that the judge's husband has links to the military, and that the access that Mr. Assange has to court documents, and he's had restricted time with his own legal team. Was there ever a sense here that Julian Assange would have been granted a fair trial, John?
No. This farrago has utterly debased the UK legal system. It's shown up to be a rancid, corrupt process, and I think the outcome to this process has already been determined. And the case as it is, the trial, if it can be so called, is merely part of a performance to give the sheen of legitimacy, ascribe some legitimacy to an outcome that, as I say, I think has already been determined, that Julian Assange will be extradited next year, unless Donald Trump steps in and issues a pardon.
Now, we're talking about all the very negative things that have happened here when it comes to the treatment of this whistleblower. So actually, has the system worked here in deterring people from following in Assange's footsteps going forward?
Well, that's obviously what it's been designed to do, and his treatment has been so, it's almost medieval, the level of hardship, the level of persecution, what he's been subjected to, solitary confinement, held in horrible conditions. His partner's tried to send him some winter clothing, that's been denied him, he's not been issued with that yet. He's he's in a prison that's riven with COVID. And prior to that, he was forced to spend 6 years in the Ecuadorian embassy, not trying to escape justice, but seeking political asylum. And if this was happening in any other country, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, then we would say, well, this is just in keeping with their cultural values. We expect nothing better from those countries, given that we deem these countries to be of a lesser culture, lesser political culture and legal culture. But it's happening in the UK, a so-called bastion of human rights and legality in our world, and it's just hypocrisy to the core. And I hope everyone who's been witness to this virago is getting an education as to the evils of this post-colonial state when push comes to shove.
Indeed, John White, thank you, as always. Now we move to some other news, because yet another deadline for negotiations about a post-Brexit deal, well, it's come and gone. On Sunday, the UK and the EU mandated negotiators to continue despite a deal or no deal target. It's an anticlimax Brits have come to expect 4 years after they voted leave. The sticking points are now access to UK fishing waters for EU vessels and corporate economic fair play rules. Bianca Rahimi fills us in.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52-48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. After it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday, the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I'll say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with 4 Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Ça fait à peine 9 mois que nous négocions.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, the security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And Jonathan Fry, the writer and commentator, is with us for his take on the weekend's developments. And Jonathan, there's still little progress that's been made on both sides. Time's running out, and some feel an extension to the transition was inevitable. So how will this go down with those who wanted to see January the 1st as Independence Day?
Well, I think what may happen is that they will perhaps agree a deal before the 31st of December, but then they will need some extra time in January for the deal to be ratified by the member states of the European Union and possibly the British Parliament as well, though it's up in the air at the moment whether MPs will actually get a vote on it. But that doesn't mean, of course, that we definitely will have a deal. It's still very much on a knife edge.
Now, Boris Johnson's attempts at negotiating directly with some of the leaders who had sticking points, France and so on, some of the newspapers here in Britain on the right, well, they took offense to that and went after Angela Merkel and Macron. Is the media tail wagging the Brexit dog, Jonathan?
Well, it's really been very depressing to see a lot of the media coverage, particularly in the right-wing conservative press. There was never any question that the EU would agree to Britain talking to individual leaders of member states. It was always going to be a collective bargaining with the EU Commission taking the lead. Well, we've had horrible headlines in the press yesterday, the Mail on Sunday, for example, accusing the German Chancellor, Frau Merkel, of wanting Britons to crawl over broken glass. Absolutely disgusting.
So how will Boris Johnson claim any kind of victory here?
I don't think he will be able to claim a big victory, whatever happens. If there's no deal, then no matter how much bluster he gives that no deal is quite a good outcome, everyone knows it isn't. There'll be tariffs and higher prices. It'll be awful. And if he does get a deal, it'll probably be a very weak deal, which many in his own party will think is a betrayal of what Brexit was all about. And I think his political career may well be on the line, whatever the outcome of the next few days.
Well, Boris Johnson is making himself fully acquainted with a rock and a hard place. Thank you very much, Jonathan Fry.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Welcome back to the Bulletin, Robert Carter. Well, you're going to kick things off with some more bad news for Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer. Tell us what's going on.
Absolutely. So obviously there has been a lot of talk surrounding his performance since taking over the biggest opposition British political party. And one of the biggest factors which could determine that would be the alleged mass exodus which is taking place within the membership of the party. His predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, was praised for reviving interest, especially among the youth in British political circles, and in particular, a huge increase in the membership numbers. However, what we're seeing under Keir Starmer potentially is the opposite, so a significant drop in people joining the party, and in fact, there could be a lot of people quitting. We don't know those figures for sure, they're only alleged because the Labour Party won't release them, but the recent NEC election that took place saw a significantly less number of people taking part in that election, which of course takes place within the party circle, so it's a local internal election process, and significantly less people took part. So it seems as if Keir Starmer is pretty unpopular and is not performing as well, at least internally within Labour, than the current leader, Keir Starmer. That's what's being suggested. We actually have some social media reaction, which will bring you a bit more of the figures behind what's happening. So perhaps we'll bring up the first tweet and see what was said. It's from Socialist Voice, a critic of the current opposition leader. It says that 293,000 Labour Party members never even bothered to vote in this year's leadership election, and only 27% voted in the recent NEC election. So Keir Starmer is hemorrhaging the membership. NEC turnout could be a result of a collapse in the membership. It's obviously suggesting that the figures are looking pretty bad internally in Labour for Keir Starmer. And the second tweet, let's bring that up on screen. It's a similar criticism. It's from Rosie, who says, it's about time that the Labour Party published their real membership numbers, not the figures prior to when Starmer took over, which were, of course, related to Corbyn rather than Starmer, especially as it seems that Starmer and the rest of his ilk no longer believe in the members' right to freedom of speech. So a little hint there at the gagging of free speech on, say, Israel, for example.
Wow, Speaking of the occupation entity, what's Algeria's warning to Tel Aviv?
A major warning coming out of Algeria. This obviously comes off the back of the news that Morocco, the neighboring country of Algeria, is normalizing ties with the Zionist regime. Algerian Prime Minister has been pretty clear. He says that he is very concerned about Israeli presence on the borders of Algeria. So obviously we know the Israeli regime takes part in covert action within the Middle East and the Muslim world, and these normalization deals could be a new opportunity for the Israeli regime to exploit that and try and go against Muslim countries which remain loyal to the Palestinian cause, such as Algeria for the time being. So let's go to the social media reaction and see what's been said. Again, it's criticism of the move overall from Sailing Serene, who says Morocco's normalization with Israel isn't the same like it has been for UAE or Bahrain, for example. The government has been accusing Morocco of being a Zionist stronghold in North Africa for years. Add this with the US recognition of Western Sahara, the reaction from Algeria will be severe. And then the second tweet I have again is also issuing some warnings here. It's from Abdul Mehdi, who says, yes, anyone putting a bet on Algeria being the next nation after Morocco to do some kind of normalization deal with Israel, rip up your ticket now. So Algeria standing by the Palestinian cause, and I guess that's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Not all of these countries are siding with Israel. Let's hope that they remain determined to stand by Palestine.
Well, let's see, because of course now Algeria has clearly made itself a target there. You know, it's put its political head above the parapet, as it were. Robert Carter, good to see you. Until next time. Now we move on to some other news now. Worrying stuff from Spain, where two neo-Nazis have been arrested in the country for selling drugs as part of a plot to make money to buy weapons for a future race war. According to Spanish police, the pair, who have not been publicly named, intended to use the money to buy weapons to create a, quote, isolated white supremacist group. After a year-long investigation, officers made the arrest in the northwestern Spanish regions of Andalusia and Pamplona after tracking a series of dangerous messages on social media. Among the messages were correspondence between the pair. Police discovered posts praising Brenton Tarrant, the Australian-born terrorist who murdered over 50 Muslim worshippers in Christchurch, New Zealand, back in 2019. The neo-Nazi pair have been released on bail pending a court appearance. London will move to Tier 3, England's highest level of coronavirus restrictions, from Wednesday. The sudden development comes just a few days after data recorded from the UK's Office for National Statistics showed that London's coronavirus cases were off the chart, with more than 24,000 new cases recorded just last week. Further data also showed 22 of the 32 London boroughs across England are currently above the national average. Speaking on the COVID-19 pandemic, the city's mayor, Sadiq Khan, warned that winter could see even more devastating rise in COVID-19 deaths if people did not follow the rules. Fighting continued on Sunday between Azerbaijan and Armenia in the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh, violating the November ceasefire that ended the bloody conflict. Azerbaijan's defense ministry said four of its soldiers were killed when their units were attacked in areas adjacent to Nagorno-Karabakh, while authorities in Armenia said six of their troops had been wounded. Speaking on the broken ceasefire deal, Russian military commander Rostam Mardov said the violation had been averted by the action of the Russian peacekeeping force, but did not specify which of the sides violated the deal first. The reports come only weeks after a 6 weeks bloody war, which resulted in the death of over 5,000 soldiers. This was ended when Azerbaijan and Armenia signed a ceasefire deal. Well, Richard, Sudan, it's going to be the worst-kept secret, but Britain's Prince Andrew's been caught out. But before you tell us that little bit of royal update, some more bad news, Richard.
So we are seeing reports that another black man has been shot dead by the police in the US in the Houston area. We know that Joshua Feast, aged 22, last Wednesday, was shot in the back by police officer Jose Santos. Now, we know that Joshua Feast was under investigation, but already the community are asking questions as to why the investigation resulted in the death of Joshua Feast. Now, what we do know that's interesting is that initially the local police were apparently not giving out much information and were not being transparent at all. One of the pieces of information they did get out was the race or skin colour of Joshua Feast, but there were not initially details about the officer involved. Those details have now been released, and imagine that Jose Santos, who was the shooter, actually has a history, a recorded history of violence against black men. He was accused in 2013 of punching and kicking an innocent black man and holding that black man's head under the water, threatening to drown him, prompting cries of "I can't breathe." So many questions, Amina, one of which is, how did Jose Santos, with a history of violence against black men, remain on the police force, leading to the death of Joshua Feast?
Richard, it seems whenever we're on together and I start the introduction by saying yet another police incident with yet another young black person, people might be saying, well, put on another record, you know, isn't there something else? But the truth is, this is now an epidemic, and I think the reaction on social media will give some kind of credence to that.
Absolutely. Let's go first to Devin Green, who says, this is my issue with the criminal justice reform police brutality conversation. It requires death to keep it going. The officer that killed Joshua Feast also kicked and punched an innocent man in 2013, and I'd be willing to bet he had other brutality issues that the police department hid. Very pertinent reaction there. Also from Breeze McDonald, we have, Joshua Feast was murdered by cops in the back. We want justice. Stay woke. The work has just begun. Get in good trouble and be heard.
Indeed. Now, speaking of trouble that might not be so good, some more very disturbing questions for one of Queen Elizabeth's sons to answer.
Just when we thought this story had gone quiet, it turns out that apparently Prince Andrew did stay at the disgraced Jeffrey Epstein's mansion in 2001. Now, this is according to sources and reports from the UK press, the Daily Mail. And the source said to the paper, not only did Andrew lie about staying at Jeffrey Epstein's mansion, he also lied about the now infamous Pizzagate alibi that he gave. He claimed he was at a Pizza Express. And apparently, the prince's own daughter has said that she can't recollect any such birthday party at a Pizza Express ever happening. So this is massively embarrassing from the prince. And of course, this was off the back of the famous car crash interview with the BBC. We're seeing video of that on the screen now, when Prince Andrew stated that he did not stay at Jeffrey Epstein's mansion. He only visited. And now it looks as though, lo and behold, who would have thought it, Prince Andrew was lying.
Oh, I for one am shocked. Also, I think from that interview, if you recall, one of the takeaways was the prince couldn't sweat. We'll just move on from that one, Richard. Some social media reaction to this.
Indeed. Let's go first to Dee, who says, I see Prince Andrew is trending, wondering how many hours and minutes it will be before something is being dug up to get at Meghan Markle, solely in order to take the heat off him. Astute observers will know the press always do diversionary tactics. And Rachel says, once he had uttered the Sweat and Pizza Express absurdities, did anyone really believe the rest of Prince Andrew's interview with Emily Matlis? This country really is enthralled to the upper class.
So, Rich, wouldn't it have been just more appropriate for Prince Andrew during that interview to say, listen, he was a friend. When what happened became public, that this man was a pervert, a pedophile, that I broke ties and I wanted to do the right thing. What's with all of this cloak and dagger, which clearly people would be now trying to disprove what he said publicly?
Indeed, and let's not forget the other excuse Prince Andrew gave in that interview. He said the reason he didn't cut ties is because he has a tendency to be too honourable. I don't think anyone's going to forget that anytime soon. But it seems as though, Amina, the prince's honour is once again being brought into a sharp question.
Right. More on that, I'm sure, as time goes on. Richard Sudan, thank you. Monitoring that story as well for us. And thank you, Stacey.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
The American regime is truly and severely suffering from a political, civil, and moral decline, and this is not mere analysis. What I am saying here is not merely an analysis. Rather, this is being acknowledged by themselves. This is being said by their spokespeople, writers, and thinkers inside the U.S. It is they who are saying this. They have written several books, published with a large circulation, bringing certain truths to light. I've read one of these books translated in Farsi. The book is filled with the proofs of this decline. If someone really reads the book, they see that from start to finish, the book speaks of the political decline of the U.S. with the moves made by the current U.S. president. Such an empire will not last long like this.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
It is evident that when one political system and regime reaches this point, it will not last long and it will be annihilated. Of course, if some of them hold office, they will destroy it sooner than the others, and there are some who make it last a little while longer should they hold office, but in any case, this is the truth of the matter. Their enmity towards us exists because we did not recognize their oppressive domination, because we did not give in to their demands and their policies in the region, because we rejected their policy on Palestine, and because we refused to accept their oppressive policies. They show us enmity, and this enmity continues in the present time. The only way to eliminate this enmity is to make them lose hope. In other words, the Iranian nation, the Iranian government, and the Islamic Republic should reach a point where the other side will lose all its hopes of delivering a serious blow to us. We should become strong.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah.
Around the world with reporters.
Angry reactions continue to pour in against the recent normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. This time, Palestinian Legislative Council in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to condemn the deal that came at the expense of the Palestinian cause.
Normalization is not a normal. It's a misleading term. It is a misleading term. It is a false term. There is no normalization with the occupation in the history. Every country suffered from occupation, tried by all means to defend themselves, even by armed struggle, in order to liberate their land. For this reason, we are refusing normalization of any country, especially country like Morocco.
Morocco is the fourth state to make such an agreement with Israeli regime since August, despite the Moroccan people's refusal of the deal that has also been struck recently with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The Moroccan king claimed he agreed to start the relations with Israel to expand economic and cultural cooperation and advance regional stability and peace.
These deals can never bring peace for Israel. The current crisis will never come to an end until the last Zionist leaves our land. The normalization deals only embolden Israel to commit more crimes.
Palestinians call on the Arab nations to dismiss these normalization deals and protest against their leaders' decisions that Palestinians consider a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
Israeli regime should be put on trial for its crimes and violations of Palestinian rights in the International Criminal Court. The Arab nations should voice their anger at the normalization deals.
U.S. used Morocco's Western Sahara claim as a bargaining chip in talks with Morocco to secure the deal and agreed to recognize Rabat's sovereignty over the territory.
While the fourth Arab country has started normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, Palestinians here stress that no deal can bring peace to their occupied territories. They say their resistance is the only way to defend the Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The recitation of a poem by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan during a military parade in Azerbaijan Republic was strongly condemned by the Iranian lawmakers and the government officials. Right after his statements, which Iran believes may fan separatism among Azeri minority, Tehran summoned the Turkish envoy. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, in a tweet, rejected the remarks, saying that no one can talk about Iran's, quote, beloved Azerbaijan. Although the Turkish foreign minister has given assurances in a phone call with Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif that Ankara respects the Islamic Republic's sovereignty and territorial integrity, the members of the parliament vehemently slammed such remarks.
In whatever way, direct or indirect, in form of a poem or any other form, such interventionist remarks are vehemently rejected by Iran. we call on the friendly state of Turkey to be watchful about their official statements, which may result in controversy. We respect the territorial integrity of the Azerbaijan Republic and Turkey and expect them to do the same.
The poem recited by Erdogan is ethnically sensitive. A president must know the repercussions of his rhetoric. This was a wrong move by the Turkish president.
Such assertions have always been strongly rejected by the Iranian officials and nation. No one is allowed to talk about Iran's territorial integrity.
Erdogan's statements come as his efforts to join the EU have been futile, and the Europeans impose more and more sanctions on Ankara under different pretexts.
Earlier, the Iranian lawmakers issued a statement condemning the remarks by the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, saying that such remarks may put the security of the region at risk. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The presidency of Donald Trump has been full of controversy in many cases due to the lawsuits and investigations of a judicial nature that he faces. However, the president has so far managed to avoid them thanks to his position and to the defense provided in some cases by the Department of Justice. This shield has an expiration date, January 20, 2021, when a new president will be inaugurated. From then on, Trump will have to face, as any other citizen, the cases that have been accumulating during these years in the courts.
I think, though, that not only has there have been concerns about what Donald Trump has done before his presidency, I wouldn't be surprised if what he will do after his presidency as well. And so the types of potential criminal allegations that have been brought against him as well as his associates are, they have a quite compelling evidence. And I think that it will be hard prosecutors will be hard pressed to ignore that evidence.
The best case scenario for Trump is there are no lawsuits or they're just frivolous and dismissed by the courts. The worst case is that they're going to have something really serious against him where he could possibly even face prison time. This is hypothetical right now. We don't have a real case of that, but there are people digging into it.
Civil cases weigh him and investigations that could have criminal implications. At the center of the investigations are his taxes, the management of his business, the use of the presidency to benefit his interests, and the defamation complaints of a woman who accused him of sexual abuse, which he has denied.
It is very possible that Donald Trump will try to pardon himself. We will be in completely new territory because, again, no president has tried this before, so the courts have never decided if it's legal or not.
Some U.S. media outlets are reporting about Mr. Trump has been asking aid since 2017 if he can self-pardon preemptively, especially on tax fraud accusations. So far, his attorneys have used the immunity argument granted by the presidency, but when he leaves the White House, they will have to reconsider his defense strategy. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvello.
After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking again a popular protest. Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation.
I have the impression that Islamophobia is an important electoral trading issue. I don't think that Marine Le Pen will win the elections, but to prevent that, the actual government is playing on the ground of the far right.
A rarely seen police cordon surrounded the demonstration entirely from the beginning till the end. Every 100 meters, the police charged the demonstration and made arrests. Some were wounded. Macron had said that the presumed radical black bloc has to be destroyed. Therefore, the police had clear orders, zero tolerance. However, this time, the violence did not come from the demonstrators. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims.
There's so much ambiguity in the formulation of the bill that anyone can be accused of anything anytime. The head of police can't dissolve any association on any grounds. With this law, justice does not exist anymore. The democratic state does not exist anymore. Anyone who is a bit annoyed by Muslims can use this law in an arbitrary way. It has to be abolished, same as the law on global security.
The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money. The new bill will be discussed in the French Parliament. Members of the majority party already declared that they want to modify the text. Some want to soften it, others want to make it even more restrictive. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
In a move lauded by Austria's Muslim community, the National Constitutional Court has officially lifted the ban on headscarves at elementary schools. The controversial ban, approved last year by the previous conservative right-wing coalition government, has now been ruled unconstitutional. The court's president says it singles out the religion of Islam unjustifiably, goes against the religious and ideological neutrality of the state, and violates the principle of equality.
The selective ban could have an adverse effect on the inclusion of students and lead to discrimination. It excludes Islamic origin and tradition and carries the risk of making it difficult for Muslim girls to access education and could marginalize them from society.
Austria's Islamic faith community, which had filed a complaint about the ban in January, welcomed the ruling, saying it would end a populist prohibition policy.
We are against constraints and prohibitions because, as it is said in the Holy Quran, there is no compulsion in the matter of faith. Our trust in the rule of law and our patience have paid off.
The ban prevented girls up to the age of 10 from wearing headscarves in school.
I think this is a big step forward because schoolgirls are often discriminated because of their hijab, and with this new rule they should be able to live it out freely and without any discrimination, even if it's by other school students or teachers. So I think it's kind of a part of a revolution.
While the opposition Social Democrats, the Liberals and the Greens all welcomed the decision, members of the Conservative ruling party called it regrettable, and the right-wing Freedom Party even suggested attempts to reinstate it. The ban's proponents argued they were protecting young girls from being pressured into observing the hijab.
But Muslim families deny this allegation, saying using force against girls who choose to wear the headscarf undermines efforts to give them equal opportunities and self-determination. And this time, they've won the argument. Homa Rezgi, Vienna.
Meeting top Afghan officials to finalize the joint comprehensive strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan was the major reason behind the visit of Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Syed Abbas Araghchi to the Afghan capital Kabul. Analysts say the move will further boost the ties between Iran and Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul was fruitful for both sides. Both sides have agreed to finalize the joint comprehensive and strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan. This is a win-win deal, helping Kabul and Tehran boost their ties.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the Iranian official stressed the importance of expansion of ties between Kabul and Tehran through numerous ways, including increase of strategic partnership in different fields. He also stressed that bringing peace and political stability to Afghanistan under an Afghan-owned process is one of priorities of Tehran's regional policy.
We would remain backing Iraqi Afghan government and people in their fight for their for peace and stability and prosperity. We do consider peace and security in Afghanistan as our own peace and security, and we do consider the prosperity of Afghan people as the prosperity of Iranians. So we are certainly after a good, constructive, mutually beneficial relations with Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul comes as both countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have recently inaugurated the first joint railway project connecting western Afghanistan to eastern Iran as a proof of growing cooperation between both countries.
Mutual ties between Kabul and Tehran are expected.